So first, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give a talk here. It's absolutely wonderful to be back at PI. I will be talking about some string theory constructions of superspin chains, and in particular, how we can try to understand the Bethe-Ghez correspondence from such constructions in a conceptually very simple way. So this is part of an attempt to understand certain relations between integrable spin chains and gauge theories. For example, the Bethe-Ghez correspondence, quantization of monopole operators in 3D n equals 4 theories in a unified way. So much of the ideas that I'm going to use and talk about have been developed by Kevin Junior, Masahito, and Witten in the last few years. So this seems like a good time to explore the implications of such things. Now, a quick recap of the Bethe-Ghez correspondence. So this correspondence relates an integrable spin chain on one side and the vacua of certain gauge theories on the other side. Well, to be more specific, I will be talking about the 2D Bethe-Ghez correspondence. Also, I will use spin chains that are non-compact. So my spins will be valued in Verma modules instead of finite dimensional representations. So the Bethe side of the correspondence refers to a spin chain. So a spin chain is just a collection of the so-called spins or some Lie algebra G, which for today I will take it to be GLM slash N. So each spin is labeled by a representation. And also a complex number called an inhomogeneity. And so this defines a Hilbert space, which is just a tensor product of all the representations. And then we can define an R matrix, which is a function of the two inhomogeneities, function of the difference. I forgot to say also rational spin chains. And by integrability, I mean that this R matrix satisfies the Young-Baxter equation, which is most easily written down in a pictorial form. So the three colors represent three representations. And at each intersection, I have an R matrix. And this gives me a non-trivial equation for the R matrix. So if we have such an R matrix, we can construct the following operator on the Hilbert space. So these are my usual spins in the spin chain. And I introduce another auxiliary spin in some representation, which intersects with all the existing spins via the R matrix and then comes back to itself. This also carries some spectral parameter, let's call them eta. And this defines an operator that acts on the Hilbert space. Now, if I put two such operators, labeled by two different spectral parameters, then the consequence of the Young-Baxter equation is that these two operators can be taken past each other, so they commute. And by expanding this equation in terms of the inhomogeneities, we get a bunch of commuting operators. Any one of them can be taken to be the Hamiltonian. And this gives me a bunch of conserved charges, hence the notion of integrability. Now, we can choose an eigenbasis for the Hilbert space that simultaneously diagonalizes all conserved charges. These basis vectors are constructed by creating certain excitations on the spin chain and giving them certain momenta. So the eigenvectors, the L eigenvectors, consists of fixed number of excitations of various types. So types here refers to, so for each simple root of my Lie algebra, I have a type of excitation. So for example, if this were an SL2 spin chain, then in the fundamental representation, it's easy to see that I only have all spin down or all spin up. So if I take all spin down to be my ground state, then there's only one type of excitation where one spin up is moving around the chain with some momentum. So each excitation has some momentum, which is also called rapidity, which I denote by, say, sigma. So this is labeled by two indices. So M refers to, say, the type of the excitation, and A refers to the Aith excitation of the given type. Now, being eigenstate means that these rapidities have to satisfy certain constraints given in terms of some equations called the Bethe equations. Let me be a bit more specific. So M goes from 1 to R, where R is the rank of my Lie algebra, and A goes from 1 to NM, where NM is the number of excitations in my eigenstate of type M. Now, there's a certain function called the Young-Young function, which depends on all these rapidities. And it can be shown that a state with these rapidities, this number of excitations, is an L eigenstate if this equation is satisfied. And this is the Bethe equation. The parameters that enter into this equation are the representations, the inhomogeneities, and so the representations, the inhomogeneities, and certain complex numbers, which are related to the boundary conditions of my spin chain. For example, if the spin of a given type goes around the spin chain, then it comes back to itself by multiplication by a phase, and that phase is determined by this complex number. So for each type, we have one complex number. So these are the parameters. All right. So this is the spin chain side of the correspondence. Now let me propose the gauge side of the correspondence. And I should say that the Bethe gauge correspondence for superspin chains with compact representations have already been proposed by Nyakarsov. So the new result here is that we propose the gauge or corresponding gauge theory for a non-compact spin chain. Well, that's the result, and then we argue for it using string theory. So the gauge theory dual of the spin chain is going to be a 2D n equals 2, 2 quiver gauge theory. So one subtlety that arises in the super spin case that does not arise in the bosonic spin case is that there isn't a unique Dynkin diagram for Lie superalgebras. So we have to make a choice of a Dynkin diagram for GLM slash N. Let's say that I randomly choose something. So these hollow nodes correspond to bosonic simple roots, and the black nodes correspond to odd simple roots. There are, I have m, okay. So the number of bosonic nodes equal to m, number of fermionic nodes equals to n. And they can be permuted arbitrarily. So each choice of, I forgot to mention that even in the spin chain side, when we write down the Bethe equation, the Bethe equations depend on a choice of Dynkin diagrams. And different choices of Dynkin diagrams lead to seemingly very different looking equations. And it's a non-trivial check that the solutions to those different sets of equations are in one-to-one correspondence. However, in string theory, when we see the construction of the spin chain or the gauge theory, it's kind of obvious that all these Dynkin diagrams give you the same sets of vacua because they correspond to certain brain manipulation that are insensitive or that cannot be detected in the IR where we see the vacua. Okay. And if there's any question, please feel free to ask. All right, so what is the gauge theory? So given this choice of Dynkin diagram, the gauge theory is going to be something like the following. Okay, so this is a, well, so I'm only talking about 2,2 Cuvier guess theory. So this is drawn in the 2,2 notation, where each edge corresponds to a chiral multiplet. The circles represent gauge groups. So for example, if I have these numbers inside the circles, then my gauge group is going to be U and I equals 1 to R. So R, again, is the rank of the Lie algebra. So for each node in my Dynkin diagram, I have a gauge node in my quiver. For each even node, I have a gauge node with an adjoint chiral multiplet attached to it. And each odd node corresponds to a gauge node that does not have any adjoint chiral. And the circular nodes correspond to flavor symmetry. So the total flavor symmetry of the theory is R plus 1.
What's L?
I'm sorry?
What's L in the
school chain? Ah. So L is the number of sides that I had. So the number of sides. So the quiver only determines the field content of the theory. To completely determine the theory, I also have to specify a superpotential. Writing down the superpotential is a bit messy, but it's easy to describe what they are. So essentially, for each loop of length 3, we have a term involving this chiral, this chiral, and this chiral. So for each loop of length 3, for example, this one, well, these are the two types that we have. Well, also we can involve this one. So we have a cubic term in the superpotential, and at the fermionic node, we have a quartic term involving these four chiral multiplets. Is the notation of the quiver clear, or does it need any clarification? I hope this is familiar. All right, so this completely specifies the theory. Now, the claim that the claim of the Bethe-Gage correspondence is that the vacua of this theory should be in one-to-one correspondence with the Bethe eigenstates of the spin chain. Now, to get a discrete set of vacua, we have to make this theory massive. So we have to turn on all possible deformations of this theory, which I will discuss in a moment. Before that, so one comment is that in order to write down the gauge theory, we also have to choose ranks of the gauge group, which are absent in the spin chain side, at least naively. The reason is that one single spin chain doesn't correspond to a single gauge theory, but rather we have to take the vacua by varying the ranks in all possible ways. The ranks essentially tell us the number of a type of excitation that we have in our Bethe eigenstates. So recall that we have R types of excitations when R is the rank of the Lie algebra, and we have R gauge nodes. And the rank of each gauge node, of course, tells us how many excitations of each type we have in the eigenstate. All right. Now, let me turn on deformations of the series so that this becomes fully massive and we only have isolated vacua. Mm-hmm. there are essentially two types of deformations that we will turn on. So one are masses for the flavor symmetry, and the other are the FI parameters for the center of all the gauge nodes. So the purpose of the flavor masses is to break each UL gauge node, UL flavor node, down to its maximal Abelian torus. So, however, we will not do this arbitrarily or in the more generic way. In total, we are okay. So our masses are going to be something like the following. So let's say alpha is some index that labels the different flavor nodes, so that for GLM slash n, this goes from 1 to m plus n. And the masses that we are going to turn on are of the following type. This is not, the exact formula looks a bit complicated, but roughly speaking, So I goes from 1 to L, and alpha goes from 1 to M plus N. And the masses that we choose at each gauge node essentially fall into L different blobs. And by blobs, I mean these are arbitrary complex numbers. So let's say if this is my complex plane, say this is zeta 1, zeta 2 is somewhere here. And these are also arbitrary complex numbers. But so one block of mass are all within order h bar of each other, centered around each of these complex numbers. So roughly speaking, what's going to happen is that these numbers are going to determine one single representation corresponding to this inhomogeneity. Okay. So these are the mass deformations that break the flavor symmetry down to its maximal Abelian torus. The other type of deformations that we're going to turn on are the FI parameters. And for each gauge node, we have one FI parameter, where m goes from 1 to r, which is m plus m minus 1. All right. So now we can kind of see the matching between different parameters. The masses that we use to break the flavor symmetry are related to the representation and the inhomogeneities. And the FI parameters that we turn on at each gauge node are related to the twist parameters tau m, which are the twisted boundary conditions. All right, OK. So since this theory is now completely massive, we can integrate out all the matter, all the chiral multiplets, and that will generate an effective twisted superpotential for the vector multiplet scalars. So let's write it as W tilde. So at each gauge node, we have a set of scalars, adjoint scalars. So this will have one label M, which corresponds to which gauge node we're talking about, and then another index, which is equal to the rank of the gauge group. So we will have some effective theory for these scalars determined by this twisted superpotential. And the vacua of this theory correspond to extremizing this twisted superpotential. Except this twisted superpotential has a logarithmic expression, and all branches are physically significant. So it's convenient to write it in an exponentiated form. And the equation for the vacua of the series looks like the following. So this gives us the vacua. And the claim is that this two-stroke superpotential is exactly the same as the Young-Young function. And the Bethe equations are exactly the same as the vacuum equation for this gauge theory.
So in other podcasts, yes, when we write this in more mathematical terms, about any homology of group writing.
That's right.
Can you do something similar here?
So we didn't do that because we're not that strong in the math side, but we can make a conjecture that, well, okay, so Kevin's question was that there's a different description of this vacua in terms of certain Cooper varieties, and the Cooper varieties correspond to the Higgs branches of this gauge theory. And in physics term, they correspond to the Higgs branches. In a more mathematical term, well, by assigning certain vector spaces to the nodes and linear maps to the edges, you can compute certain variety by taking reduction of some affine space that corresponds to the Higgs branch. And these vacua are, again, in one-to-one correspondence with, let me write it somewhere else. So let's say this is my quiver Q. So associated to each quiver, I have a Higgs branch. And the Higgs branch carries an action of the flavor group. And with respect to that action, we can compute the equivariant cohomology of the Higgs branch. And a basis for this equivariant cohomology also corresponds to the vacua of my theory. So one consequence of the Bethe gauge correspondence is that there is an action of the Young-Young of GLM slash N on the quiver varieties for these kind of quivers. So I think this has been proven in the purely bosonic case, which corresponds to quivers where all of these things have adjoint nodes. But as far as I know, this has not been proven for this type of quivers. So we leave this as an open conjecture.
Which quiver you're a little confused about the pictures. So which one is the framing here and which one is the...
So these are the framings.
The framings, and then you have so I'm just trying to understand the picture. So you have one edge in this direction, and then you have also loops. And
These were something else. So ignore the blue lines for the moment.
Okay, so I'm confused. So this is the quiver before doubling or after doubling?
I'm sorry, so what do you mean by doubling?
I mean, usually when you find a Kachima quiver variety, you usually have each edge is doubled. So you
have, that's right.
So is it?
So this would be before doubling, I think.
In so that means that if you look at it in horizontal errors, and after doubling, you have four horizontal errors.
No, so this is. Oh, sorry. I misspoke. This is after. After the doubling. I'm sorry?
This won't give you something symplectic. Like in the usual cases,
yes,
it was a 2-2 theory that happened to have 4-4 supersymmetry.
Right.
But this does not happen.
Right. But so isn't the consequence of that that you wouldn't get something hyperkähler, but just something kähler?
Yeah, so this in this example, we should just be kähler.
Oh, yes.
So it's like, it's not going to have
to be. That's right.
That's fine, but that's how we define. So when you say quiver, right, so you just take this quiver the way it means. This particular quiver, and then you just take the whatever, Hamiltonian reduction.
Yes.
There's some sort of tension.
Yeah, so the blue lines refer to certain superpotentials.
No, okay, I understand that. That's how. Okay, I see. So, and so your conjecture is that if you think it's cohomology, then you have the action of this Young-Young.
Yes.
So I'm confused where M and M and this feature is.
Right. This quiver was based on a Dynkin diagram for GLM slash N.
Yes.
So let's say this is a Dynkin diagram. So these empty nodes correspond to bosonic simple roots, and the solid nodes correspond to fermionic simple roots. So the number of bosonic nodes is equal to M, and the number of fermionic nodes is equal to
M. Is there some particular choice of simple roots, or is it because of GLM?
That's right.
There are many different choices.
That's right. So for any choice of, so you would get different quivers for different choices, but for any choice, this should be true. Oh, okay. I should, what I wrote earlier is incorrect, as it was written. There has to be a sum over all ranks.
So ranks means N odds.
These N, yes.
And L is fixed.
L is fixed, yes.
And it's the same L
everywhere. Everywhere, yes.
It should also be a particular representation.
Yes, of course. Yes.
It's a part of the algorithm.
That's right.
So I'm confused. What's the story? The relation between the Dynkin diagram and this quiver. So again.
So for each node in the Dynkin diagram, I draw a gauge node.
Yes.
And all gauge nodes are connected by two parallel lines. For each bosonic node, I attach a loop.
Oh, so this I attach only bosonic node. That's it. Okay.
That's right.
And if fermionic node, nothing.
That's right.
Okay. And do you know anything about the heat branches, like a smooth variety, for example?
I don't know, unfortunately.
Do you know an example of it? For instance, what would happen if, say, M is equal to 0?
Well, if one of them is equal to 0, then I think...
Is it something familiar from something else?
If one of them is 0, then I think they are familiar. I think these are just then Hamsa quiver varieties. Or...
I see. You know, but if it's a nice of Cooper, I think that the thing that's kind of modular description describes, say, in terms of like a monopole. So, do you have any modular description for those?
I am not sure I fully understand the modular description, but what is it exactly?
I mean, it's a modular space of sound.
Oh.
Kind of geometrically.
So if you say monopole, then yes. I mean, so I can just.
Do you have some kind of monopole description?
I don't at the moment, but that's something that I'm looking into right now. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, that's a very interesting question, but yeah, I don't have an answer yet. All right, so I have presented the main claim that there's this gauge theory whose massive vacua are in one-to-one correspondence with the beta eigenstates of some spin chain. And to check that this is true is simple. We can write down explicitly what the two-state superpotential is for this gauge theory once we integrate out all the massive fields. And that does give us the beta equations that we would expect from an integrable spin chain. Now, the main motivation for starting this project was to understand why such relations exist. Because a priori, there's not much common between this gauge theory and the spin chain. And so that's the next part of the talk. I'm going to erase. I'll use this. All right. So here our main tool is a very interesting four-dimensional gauge series, which is 4D-term Simons, proposed by Kevin and later used to study integrability in a very simple way by, again, Kevin, Witten, and Yamazaki. So this has an interesting looking action. With gauge group GLM slash N. So here, this is some topological surface indicating that this 4D theory will be topological on this plane and some complex curve indicating that this theory will have holomorphic dependence on the coordinates of this curve. H bar is always Planck's constant everywhere, up to factors of numbers. All right, so in this theory, we can consider line operators. Let's say this is my sigma, and this is my complex curve. So then I can consider line operators that are parallel to the topological plane and have fixed locations on the Riemann surface, the locations being some complex numbers. And they will indeed be identified with the inhomogeneities or the spectral parameters when we say that these lines correspond to those lines in the integrable spin chain. So here, A is the connection for this gauge group. And omega is the holomorphic volume form on the Riemann surface. So R matrix in this context is given by an expectation value of two crossing line operators. So these angular brackets refers to taking expectation values in this series. So when we compute expectation values of two line operators that goes off to infinity at both ends, we have to provide some states at the two ends. So this will belong to, and of course each line operator will carry a representation of GLM slash N. So I start with some tensor product state. This becomes some other tensor product state. And this gives me a map from Vi, Vj to Vi, Vj. And so my definition of integrability is that this R matrix satisfies Young-Baxter equation, which is a simple consequence of the fact that this theory is topologically invariant in the topological plane. So I can take line operators and move line past an intersection. The main point is that since I have this extra dimension, and these lines are separated in this extra dimension, they actually never intersect. And because of the topological invariance on sigma, these two configurations will be indistinguishable. And that's the Young-Baxter equation. So the point is that line operators in Fourier and Simons give me a construction of integrable spin chains. So then the next thing to do is to take a Bain construction of this Fourier and Simons theory involving some line operators. So that will tell us how we can embed an integrable spin chain into string theory. The benefit of that is that in string theory, we have many dualities. And we can take one setup of Bain configuration and map it to something else and see what happens to these states. There's not much here, so here is this. Okay. So we start in type 2B. And our 10-dimensional spacetime, we take it to be C times the cotangent bundle of the topological plane times tau naught. And then we put M d phi brains on C times sigma times. Well, so tau naught has a description of a family of cigars parameterized by an S2. So it can look something like this. So I take two cigars that are opposite to each other. Let's call this cigar plus, cigar minus. So I put M d phi brains on C times sigma times one of the cigars, and N d phi brains on C times sigma times the other cigar. Then one can check that in this background, there's a particular supercharge, which if we take the cohomology of the theory with respect to that supercharge, that is, we're only looking at observables invariant under that supersymmetry, then that gives us a topological holomorphic theory in six dimensions. It's on the d phi brains. So we will have a UM gauge theory here and a UN gauge theory here. So this will be a certain 6D topological holomorphic theory with UM gauge symmetry. And this is the same 6D theory with a different gauge symmetry. But they intersect in four dimensions. And there are open strings joining these two cigars that are localized at the intersection. So if we look at what theory we get from these open strings, so that's the Kapustin twist of 4dn equals 2. All right. To relate this to something that is somewhat older is that we can T2-alize along the circle fiber of the tau naught, which then, via standard string theory result, gives us an NS5 brain. So the tau naught, the center of the tau naught becomes an NS5 brain, and the D5 brains become D4 brains, losing one dimension. So we have M d4 brains ending on the NS5 from the left, and N d4s ending on the NS5 from the right. And this setup was started by Michaela van Witten to show that at the boundary of this theory, so along this NS5 brain, you find an analytically continued 3D transimer theory with gauge group GLM slash N. So this is essentially a T-dual of what we're doing here. Okay, so to this setup, now, so we have a 6G theory coupled to a 4D theory. We can reduce the dimensions by turning on an omega deformation. So omega deformation in this case can be described geometrically by twisting this product in a certain way, which I'm not going to go into much detail right now, but it's pretty much a straightforward thing to do. So essentially, we have to twist some of these products, do some T-dualities and so on, and keep track of the various background fields and see what happens to the deep brain world volume theories in presence of those background fields. But the bottom line is that the MD5 brain theory by itself reduces to Wordich and Simons with GLM gauge group supported on the intersection C times sigma. The ND5 brain theory for Wordich and Simons with GLM gauge group. And this coupled-spin twist of Wordich n equals 2 they give us a bunch of fermionic bifundamental matter. And by bifundamental, I mean bifundamental with respect to GLM and GLN. And all these fields can be combined very nicely. And write down a theory involving a single field where we put the two bosonic gauge fields in the diagonal parts and the fermionic bifundamentals, we put them in the off-diagonal. And this becomes a GLM/N connection. And the theory written in terms of this connection is precisely the Wordich and Simons theory. So that's how we end up with Wordich and Simons from type 2b. So one interesting point in all of this is that which is also present in the bosonic case, that even though we start from gauge theories with real Lie groups, we end up with gauge theory with complexified Lie groups. Okay. So now we need to introduce line operators in our Wordich and Simons theory. So let me simplify the space-time a little bit and choose as our sigma to be just R2, and as the holomorphic direction, just the complex plane. And I'm going to write down top knot also as end of R2 times R2. And we have two extra directions. So this is really the top knot. And by plus h bar and minus h bar, I mean that we have omega deformation turned on that rotates the circle fiber of the top knot, which rotates the two cigars in opposite direction. So I'm writing them as simply R2. Okay. Our original D5 brains were here, D5 plus minus. A brain wrapping cigar plus is denoted by plus, same for minus. Now we put some extra D3 brains. Let me draw a simple picture. So the idea, so the blue lines are DFAB minuses, the white lines are the DFAB pluses, the vertical ones. And we introduce D3 pluses ending on D5 pluses and D3 minuses ending on D5 minuses. And so from the brain configuration, we see that they intersect in one dimension in the support of the Fortich and Simons theory. So after localization, these D3 brains simply introduce some line operators. And okay, so in this picture, the vertical direction is holomorphic direction. This is Rx or Y. So we can tune the locations of the D2 brains on the along the D5 brains in the holomorphic direction. So each D2 brain has a complex number attached to it. And this complex number becomes the inhomogeneity of the line operator they create. Now a single line operator is created by one D2 brain ending on each D5, but their locations is tuned in a particular way in the C direction so that they are all within order h bar of the inhomogeneity zeta. And how they are distributed around this point determines the representation. Well, so any positioning of the distributions will create some line operator, but we are looking for our Verma modules, and that corresponds to tuning their locations in this particular way. So if we want to create a spin chain of length L, we put L of these brains on each D5 brains. And tune the location of each set of L D3s in a particular way. Well, so that gives us the line operators in Fortich and Simons. Now, so what are the states in the representations V in terms of the brain configuration? So those are given by fundamental strings that are attached to the D3s and the D5s. And we can consider all possible configurations of fundamental strings, only the supersymmetric ones. That gives us all the states in the representations. So then it's an easy question that what happens to these fundamental strings as we go to different duality frames. In particular, we can first apply an S duality. So an S duality will turn D5s into NS5s. So I'm applying S now. The D3s remain D3s. We can further do a T-duality in one of the topological directions so that D3s become D4s. And S-dualities also turn the F1s into D1s. So let's say we consider all possible configurations of D1s. And the T-duality will turn the D1s into D2s. So ultimately, we end up with some configuration that look like this. We have NS5s of two kinds, D4s ending on the NS5s, and D2s suspended between NS5s. From this, we can easily read off a gauge theory living on the D2 brains. This is a very old result, how to get the gauge theory by Hanani and Hori. And we will find that we get exactly this kind of quiver gauge theories. So whenever we have parallel NS5s, these D2s can fluctuate in some extra directions corresponding to this adjoint node, adjoint chiral. And when we have opposite kinds of NS5s, the D2s cannot fluctuate and we don't get the chirals. Well, essentially, that's the only non-trivial thing from the brain configuration. Now, vacua of this D2 brain world volume theory correspond to positions of the D2 brains in the vertical direction where we don't break supersymmetry. And those are given by the vacuum equation in this duality frame. And in the other duality frame, those are the supersymmetric fundamental strings corresponding to states in the spin chain. Now, so as I was saying that we have multiple choices of the infinite diagrams. And that simply corresponds to taking one type of NS5 plus another type of NS5. And if we look at the brain configurations carefully, we can see that we can do that without actually any five brains intersecting each other. So this is just a Hahn-Newton transition. And we expect that Hahn-Newton transitions do not change the vacuum structure. So the set of vacua before and after are, of course, in one-to-one correspondence.
Are you saying that the 2D theories are
equivalent? Yes. And of course, to get all the states in the spin chain, we have to consider all supersymmetric configurations of F1 strings. Similarly, we have to consider all possible configurations of D2 strings, varying their numbers, and that contributes the sum over ranks in the quivers. So I think I'm out of time. So this was the basic setup of, well, this was the basic argument behind our proposal for the Bethe-Gesch correspondence for non-compact superspin chains. But as I was saying, that this is really a proof of concept that embedding spin chains this way into string theory can be very fruitful to understand the relations between various incarnations of integrability in Gesch theories by applying string dualities. And there are some more results in these directions that we have found since this paper. Well, if anyone is interested, I'll be very happy to talk to you. That's it. Thank you.
Any more questions for the feeds?
No. Very easy question I'd ask. So, what is quiver is something there's something right. Is, do you know any example which, you know, in the case of either M or M, what M and, let's say, M and N are both known zero, in that case, do you know any example how this right looks like?
I think the GL11 case for like two spins is actually quite simple to work out the Higgs branch. That's let me see. So the theory is going to be. So one NS5 plus, one NS5 minus. And have, let's see. I think it's just this. What is a Higgs branch?
Sorry, I think it's GL11, but where are one circle?
Let me see. So if it is GLM slash N?
Oh, because this is one, the simple roots.
That's right. And this one corresponds to the occupation number in the spin chain. I don't know if there's a more familiar term. So this essentially corresponds to a spin chain with two sites, each in some Verma module, and with one excitation going on in the spin chain. I don't know right now what this bunch is.
I get a sense you said it's on M and N, either M or M equals zero, you get essentially this change of quiver, but I'm confused because somehow it's kind of not symmetric with respect to M and N, right? You said that you. It is because
let's see. So, I think the finite dimensional case in this case is slightly more familiar, although I didn't talk about how to get to the finite dimensional representations. The finite dimensional, if I take two spins in fundamental representations and one excitation, then The Cooper variety is going to be, well, whatever variety you get from this Cooper. I think this is, I'm sure that this is very simple and known. What is it?
Huh? I think in this case, we found the total space of O minus one plus O minus one over P one.
Ah.
This is one Magnon sector, two spins, the fundamental representation and SL1/1.
Right.
Yeah.
Did we compute the equivalent cohomology of this? I don't think we did, right?
I don't think so.
Okay.
So this
I think this is the Higgs bunch of this theory.
So the cohomology is two dimensional.
Yes. Yeah. We did leave some exercises undone. We should do that.
There's a in the usual case, like the non-supercritical case, there's a lot of work beyond just counting the vacua.
Mm-hmm.
Like people say, the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian expressed in terms of quantum cohomology, and there's all this stuff about quasi-maps that I don't really understand. Would you expect that kind of thing to happen here?
I mean, I know that those results exist, and since I know very little, I can conjecture that they should exist, but I really am not the right person to make a strong claim. Well, I think Surya is in the audience. Maybe he has better intuition about this than I do.
I also don't really understand the results about quasi-maps, even in the bosonic case, unfortunately. But maybe it's worth noting that there are some results about like compact superspin chains, like the analog of this Yangian action. Like we did try and write down the R matrix using something like Mollikin-Kunkov's stable bases. Their construction doesn't apply in the superspin case because, like, as we pointed out earlier, the Higgs branches won't be holomorphic symplectic. But in the compact superspin chains case, there's some recent work of Richard Romani and Lev Rozanski that constructs the corresponding, like, the stable bases.
Yeah, I should also comment a bit more about that paper that Surya mentioned, which is a mathematical paper, but they work out what happens when we change the Dynkin diagrams and how the superpotentials transform in terms of the quiver. And they really do correspond to Hahn-Witten transitions in the brain setup. So they already have an intuition about that in their work.
Stability condition is quiver?
Stability conditions?
Yeah. It seems that.
Isn't that the non-zero FA parameters? Is that the same?
FA parameter is a deformation parameter.
So what is the stability condition?
Which means that one of the maps should be surjective.
Right. So we don't say it in that language, but so you need.
It comes from the D-term equation.
That's right.
In order to get the O minus one direction with O minus one, you should get the, you should impose this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Sasha was explaining that in the bosonic case, there are known relations between these queer varieties and modular spaces and monopoles. And we can also kind of see that from the Venn construction of these gauge theories by going to some duality frames where these vacua correspond to certain vertex configurations in a 3D n equals 4 theory. And then we can argue that the monopole operators are really acting on the spin chain by going to another duality frame. So as far as I know, something similar does not yet exist in the superspin case, but our brain construction should, well, I expect that this will be a relatively easy way to study these things. This is something that I'm working on with Yehav at the moment.
Okay, so I've forgotten I was the chair, so if there's no more questions, we should thank Nafis again.